All right, welcome back to the Ellison Report. It's this week's edition, the broadcast podcast hybrid journal of politics, policy, and the people. Here we explore the issues rather than rant on about the latest trends and headlines. And we're at the home of Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm your host and executive producer, Charles Ellison, here at the WEAA studios, Morgan State University. Also on the board is both Tyron Rice, producer, and also producer Andre Melton, both on the board of Steel. And we're all set to give you an hour of insightful public affairs programming. You can find me at Ellison Report on Twitter, by the way. Just catch me there if you can. Catalina Byrd is our illustrious correspondent here at WEAA. You know, she's a political strategist, media relations strategist extraordinaire here in the city of Baltimore. She joins us by phone. How are you doing, Catalina?
I'm good, and you?
All right, good, good.
Hey,
always on the go, Catalina. So, and definitely, I appreciate your time. I did want to get your thoughts on last week's drop of the Department of Justice investigation, or the report on the Baltimore City Police Department. Obviously, that's been discussed quite a bit here on WEAA. It's been discussed quite a bit in the national discourse. But I wanted to get your thoughts on it, Catalina, and first kind of start with, you know, just sort of at the high level, what sort of stood out for you? What's good about this report? What's not so good, or what's missing in it?
Well, that was a loaded question, Charles. there's not a lot of good in it, honestly, because it wasn't a good time for the city. It looked at 2010 and 15. We were still very much reeling from the O'Malley administration's zero tolerance policy that it had adopted. And it was a community that was broken. I think that shows how we got to the uprising. Mm-hmm. It is a clear snapshot of what the frustrations of the people in the community were, and why they felt that way. One of the things I think that's not in it, though, because of the lack of distinction, is I found it disheartening that there was only about a paragraph and a half about how the LGBT and transgender community is treated. It was kind of folded into the gender bias section, mm-hmm. which was focused more on sexual assault reports from women to male officers, and lots of instances where they didn't believe the woman. But the transgender and LGBT community, serious sexual assault, and I don't know that it's a gender bias so much as allowed homophobia, mm-hmm. that makes them a more vulnerable population. Mm. And that wasn't fully reflected in that. I don't believe. But other than that, the good news is that under the direction of Commissioner Kevin Davis, in the last year, processes have been put in place. Work is being done to right these wrongs. A lot of it in being proactive, knowing that this report was going to be bad, and having come in and assess what he thought the report was going to find and start addressing those things immediately instead of waiting for the report to come out. So that's the good news that the report doesn't reflect, and I wish that more people in the media would take the time to find out. Let's not focus just on the report. Let's focus on what's happened in the last past year since the uprising as it pertains to police and community relations and the efforts on both sides to repair that.
Well, what's your gauge, or what's your take on the overall community reaction, Catalina? Is it relief? Is it frustration? Is it just sort of a collective shrug?
For some folks, it's just like, we already knew this. This is a freeze you could have saved, paper you didn't have to write.
Right.
For some other people, it's sad. They know it, but they seeing it in black and white from an outside agency is still very different for them emotionally. And then I've been listening, and, you know, for a lot of the more affluent, especially some of the white members of our city who live kind of attached to our communities of color, now they realize that these activists and community organizations are exaggerating. Now they see the proof of what our communities have been saying that we were treated disproportionately. Now they see it for themselves, and hopefully that eye opening will help us bridge some gaps in some communities and resources so we can just have one Baltimore.
You know, Catalina, I get the sense that a year or more than a year after that unrest here in Baltimore City. I get this feeling as though, you know, sort of back to business as usual as far as the city's political and business elite, you know, still a focus on, okay, let's regroup and let's also look at more development in the harbor, the downtown area. And then that'll just sort of trickle down to everyone else. And so do you have any faith that that political and business community, that folks who participated in that unrest or who were also, you know, involved in that unrest, you know, they were trying to get a signal to folks who run the city that, you know, something has got to dramatically change here. I mean, do you have any confidence that something like this report can push people in that direction towards that change?
Well, I think that the uprising did that. The uprising said that too. That was the clarion call of uprising, that our community, Pennsylvania Avenue specifically, has looked like this since we had actual riots in 68. Mm-hmm. And so the damage that you're showing the world that you're claiming was done last year has been here for 40 plus years, right? And so that call has been made. And so there's been an investment from Wells Fargo into Upton Planning, allowing them to redo some historic buildings. There's Innovation Village, which is a partnership between Coppin and MICA and a private developer. They're going to redevelop 8.5 mile footprint in West Baltimore and Sandtown, Winchester. So now it's being done. Mm-hmm. It's sad that it took an uprising to get it there. And a report like this to continue to focus on why it needs to be there. But if that's what it takes to make a difference for West Baltimore, for parts of East Baltimore, for these communities that have kids that deserve better.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I'm real curious about, Catalina, in that report, did you see anything about the housing of police officers or how the housing segregation or the fact that many Baltimore police officers live outside of the places they patrol has a significant impact on how they're treating the citizens that they police? And I'm wondering if there was anything in there in that report about that.
The way that the report is outlined, it doesn't show a bias because of geography. It was looking for civil rights violations, so it's very issue specific around sexual assault, protected speech. There's a lot of incidents that are reported in it where they arrested people who said things that they didn't like about law enforcement as kind of a retaliatory act. So it's more like that. But and then it also then dissects into numbers, discrimination, disparities, specifically upon African Americans. Mm-hmm. Those are the only things it breaks it down into. But one of the things that has been a challenge for recruiting from Baltimore for some time now for the police department is, you know, have they ever smoked marijuana or had like a marijuana possession charge? And so that's something that the commissioner has now changed to try to, and again, being proactive in trying to create an environment where we can recruit locally and remove some of the barriers that have kept some of our local people from being able to come off. But, you know, that is not going to be in the report. Something I know that some different mayoral candidates in the past have called for is a residency requirement like Boston
right.
has. And that's something that the FOP and our current administration has been adamantly against for whatever reason. But there's a number of reasons why it would work and it would be beneficial to the city because then they would be part of our tax base adding to our revenue.
Yeah, I feel
that's
like
something we have to keep in discussion.
Right. I feel like that's a big issue. I mean, could that be an issue that could sort of change the tone and direction of the Baltimore mayoral general election? Because, you know, we had the primary. Folks, I guess, pretty much figured that the Baltimore mayoral election was over after the primary. But we actually have a general election coming up. And there's actually you have other candidates besides the Democratic nominee who are running. I mean, could that become like a flashpoint for a major conversation up till November?
I don't believe so, unfortunately, while it should be. But because Democrats have run Baltimore City since 1967, there's a 30 to 40% drop-off in return to the poll between the primary and general.
Yeah.
And most people aren't paying attention, and the media doesn't create platforms to bring attention to the fact that the race is still going on. So there's no discussion around the mayor's race at all, so there's no issue that can lead to discussion.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Kelly, one last, I've got you for like maybe a minute or two more. I'm going to take host prerogative and give myself another minute. I'm real curious to get your perspective on the lack of enforcement teeth in reports like this, or the lack of an accountability mechanism, because we haven't just seen this with Baltimore. We saw this, like, it was a report for Ferguson. There's a probe of Chicago Police Department. You know, when these major incidents happen, they go viral on social media. They make a headline in all the major news outlets. Department of Justice responds with a probe, with a report. But it doesn't seem like there's much enforcement teeth afterwards. I mean, are you concerned about that? I mean, are folks in Baltimore like, okay, we got this report, but, you know, what else is the federal Justice Department going to do about it?
Well, because of, and I'm not sure if this happened in Ferguson or Chicago or not, but we are now having to enter into a consent decree.
Yeah.
Where we will be, our department will be overseen until the recommendations are made. I think it's a period of 5 to 8 years. So, and it's enforceable with mandates and fines. So this is us being held accountable. And I don't know if that happened in Ferguson, but we're going to have
to a degree it did. Yeah, and to a degree it didn't. Yeah.
And again, and it happened in Prince George's County some years ago while Kevin Davis was there. So we have experience of working with the federal government on this.
Mm-hmm.
Making the corrections in the time frame so that it doesn't become a burden of the taxpayers. And so that that gives me hope that the change is really going to come.
All right, I've been talking with Catalina Byrd, WEAA's own Catalina Byrd, also a political and media strategist. She's been joining us by phone. And we'll talk to her again, I'm sure.
Of course.
Hey, thanks so much, Catalina. Take care,
no
okay?
Problem.
Be safe.
All right.
All right. We will be back for the next segment of the Ellison Report. I believe we have Marcus Farrell. He's former director of African-American outreach for the Bernie Sanders campaign. He's going to be coming on to talk about third parties and other political alternatives for black voters. Here at your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. The Ellison Report is made possible by generous support from Oneness Mobility, more at onenessmobility.com, and with support from BE Strategy, more at strategybe.com. Joining us now by phone is Marcus Farrell. He is a former director of African American outreach for the Bernie Sanders for President campaign. Obviously, he's busy on other projects these days, and he's been gracious enough to join us by phone. Want to talk about third parties or third party alternatives or other sorts of electoral alternatives for black voters. What that means has been a big debate, a big discussion about that. I figured Marcus will be a perfect expert or subject matter expert to talk with about that. Marcus, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. Excellent. So, yeah, tell me, Marcus. So, you know, there's been this ongoing debate about, because we have not just Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump running for president, but we also have third party candidates like Gary Johnson for the Libertarians and Jill Stein for the Green Party as well. So it's been a big discussion and some thought discourse regarding alternatives for black voters. Some people saying that black voters should look at those third party candidates, especially folks like Jill Stein. Where do you stand on that?
Well, OK, first, out of all clarity, I am a Democrat. I've been a Democrat for 20 years, but I'm off as an African American. Like, here's the thing. We need to make sure that folks earn our vote. I mean, it's that simple. So whoever gets us free the fastest should probably warrant whoever does the work to actually do outreach in our communities and actually speak to our issues deserves our vote. And I don't care if that's Green, Democrat, or Republican. The assumption our ancestors passed away for the right to vote. The assumption that we are just locked in lockstep with a political party is not a really good look for us. Because, I mean, You know, my whole life as a Democrat, economically, my neighborhoods have not changed. The neighborhood that I grew up in has not become a affluent neighborhood just because of how we have voted. Nothing has changed for us in years. So, yeah, it should be a legitimate conversation about more than just parties, but candidates and issues and what we vote for. There needs to be a complete overhaul in the thought process of African Americans when it comes down to the value of our vote.
So what do you say, though, Marcus, when you have concern there that suddenly if you have a major shift of or even like a marginal shift of black voters from the Democratic bloc, particularly in this election, to a third party candidate, that creates a very alarming scenario where a person like a Donald Trump gets into the White House? How do you respond to critics who point that out, that and also point out one example being the 2000 presidential election where Ralph Nader was the spoiler and George Bush ended up being a two-term Republican president. And then, you know, everything else after that happened.
Right, right. Well, first off, statistically, scientifically, Ralph Nader's candidacy did not help George Bush. He took more votes away from George Bush than he did from Al Gore.
Mm-hmm.
People tend to try to view that number. But that's factually wrong, and a lot of folks don't look into that. Secondly, is the next president going to take black people out of blighted neighborhoods? Is the next president going to take black folks out of poverty? Is the next president going to take African Americans and actually stop brutal treatment from police departments? We have to have a keep it real conversation as African Americans. Who is helping us? We can talk about, have a dialogue all day long about the next president and how bad Donald Trump will be. But I have a funny feeling that African Americans will be in the same situation that they are right now, no matter who gets elected. So we should be talking about, we should be holding our candidates' feet to the fire when it comes down to who we vote for. Now, I'm going to say something. If Hillary Clinton, I'm not a Hillary hater. If Hillary Clinton does what she says she's going to do with this new progressive Democratic platform, then you know what? Vote for Hillary. But, you know, African Americans have been sold things for such a long time that it's hard for some of us progressive black folks to just believe that. So, I mean, we're at a crossroads right now. And to be honest with you, if we don't wake up and start allowing folks, and start making folks be accountable and work for our vote and actually speak to our issues, again, we're not going to see anything change. So am I worried about a Donald Trump presidency? Dude, I'm black. Like, does that matter to me?
Right. Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, let's just keep it honest. I mean, I want to keep it 100, right? Like,
right.
Does the next black president stop us from being hurt? I mean, the next president stop us from being hurt as a community? I'm 90% of the way to say it's going to be the same thing for us, no matter who gets elected out of the current two options.
Hey, you know, I did want to ask you, Marcus, did you feel like that that real hard pivot to the left that the Democratic primary took, did that successfully force Hillary Clinton, who's now the Democratic nominee, to pursue progressive policies in her platforms? We just had her economic speech last week, and so did you feel like that hit the right progressive points in the wake of that caustic Democratic primary? Did you feel like on some levels Bernie Sanders accomplished what he set out to do, and that was to shift the Democratic Party more to the left?
Here's the thing. Hillary is talking right, but the campaign and the support is acting wrong, I believe, right? But Hillary is talking right. She's saying the right thing. The platform is right where, I mean, we didn't get everything we wanted, but we got a lot of it, right? Progressives got a bunch of it. But, I mean, let's keep it honest. The Democratic Party is a party that prides itself on being a big tent. But now that tent is letting in Republicans. Now that tent is asking for Henry Kissinger endorsement. So something has to give, and it might not be during this primary, but definitely in a presidency where, they are trying to literally go hard right and maintain a progressive point, something has to give. It's not going to be able to maintain where it is right now. And I'm going to be very interested in seeing a Clinton administration who's trying to be progressive, yet and still trying to appease the very big money interest or the very big Republican interest that's currently going on right now.
Yeah, I'm real curious and engaging you on some of your points about black voters, black folks gravitating towards third party alternatives. And so, is that really the most viable alternative? Say, black voters get very engaged, or very involved with, say, the Green Party, and they really haven't perfected the art of dominating the two major parties, the Democratic and Republican parties. I mean, some of that onus is on the African-American political community as well, not doing a very good job of that compared to some other demographic groups where, you know, they've got leverage in each of those parties. So why not have that conversation since those two major political parties still kind of control things, rather than a conversation with that sort of reinvents the political wheel a little bit, some folks could argue, for African-Americans?
Well, you just hit it. Leverage. Mm-hmm. We need to stop being a black vote mm-hmm. in general.
Mm-hmm.
We need to have a black agenda that is actually projected in these campaigns, which currently is not. There's a certain level of pandering instead of a certain level of policy.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to see that. I mean, right now, folks are using the terminology woke, right? There is an awakening in our black millennials right now, where I have to be very proud of them for them understanding, okay, this ain't right and it's been going on for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So be it a third-party option, be it progressive African-American leadership, be it progressive politics in general, yes, we should figure out, but it starts with us figuring out what we want and then being and having enough integrity in our politicians to actually fight for those things and say, we're not going to support you unless you say these things that help out our community. And it needs to be more than piecemeal when it comes down to African-American leadership. They don't need to be taken care of, and then the community that voted them in is still in blight, is still impoverished. That's a problem that we're having right now, where when one of us make it, you're not reaching back and bringing your community that voted you in
mm-hmm.
there with you. If that was a thought process, then yes. But right now they are using the current system to actually sort of cheat and just stay in office for years and years and years. And if they're going to do that, then eventually they're going to miss out on a whole generation of voters.
Mm-hmm.
So should third parties be considered? Absolutely. But we have to figure out our agenda first.
You know, Marcus, and how powerful would that be strategically, or would it be more powerful for that realignment that you're describing to happen on the state local level? Maybe that start with that focus, you know, kind of like how that's sort of how Republicans got to where they are right now in terms of building up on the state and the local level and then taking over state legislatures, governor's mansions. Tea Party did a bit of that too, you know, kind of focusing from dog catcher to school board and then working their way up. Do you feel like that there's not enough state and local focus? Maybe that idea of independent political movements or independent parties or third parties, maybe that's much, at the moment, much more realistically operational on the state and local level. I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Right. So yes, like campaigns are ran by money and people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Either you're contacting voters or you're raising money. That's a good mantra for political candidates. You're not going to get a lot of money right now as a Green Party candidate. So the way you negate that is you contact more people. Where most of these school board races, most of these some of these city council races in small areas can be won by having an extremely good field plan and a field game,
mm-hmm.
where you're knocking on doors and you're contacting voters face to face. once they get in, if they get in, a third party gets into office, that Green Party or that Libertarian Party, and I do question some of the Libertarian Party motives, by the way, I will say that.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have a sustainable opportunity to actually become elected and raise your profile and be able to raise money on a major level.
Mm.
Right now, it's on the Green Party to try to figure out what target, what seats they can think they can win, and then start raising the name idea of some of these candidates. And I know for a fact that the Green Party is trying to do African American outreach at an extreme level right now, because I believe that they think they see an opening. The same thing that happens with the Democrats in the 60s and 70s. You have to put yourself in these communities and actually talk to their issues. So yes, you're absolutely right. The third party candidates that need to start small and then work their way up, or either put progressive candidates in the major party and try to change it. Which a lot of folks, that's the argument right now. There's definitely a battle between the soul of the Democratic Party,
mm-hmm.
right? And that is what's leading us to this argument. A lot of folks are so used to status quo that they can't see themselves not being a Democrat, and they see the Democratic Party being something that looks more like the Green Party, except professional. So, I believe that happens to a lot of Bernie's black surrogates. I believe that happened to a lot of Bernie's African-American supporters in general.
Mm.
Most of them went back to the Democratic Party, but they are not speaking their language. And now I'm starting to hear a lot from a lot of leadership and a lot of prominent African-American supporters that supported Bernie, like, man, maybe I should take a look at the Green Party because of the attitude, because of the thought process, because of the moves that are being made, are happening made by the DNC.
But then you could also make the argument that no matter what party you go to, Democrat, Republican, even Green Party, you still have a situation where they're dominated by pretty much white voices, white perspectives. There are critics who say that, you know, white liberals are just as bad about this as white conservatives are, and not being very, if not inviting, not caring too much about black political empowerment, or not being very open to the whole notion of black political power or some sort of black political infrastructure within their organizations, like the Green Party. And so what do you say to that? Have you seen a lot of that? Have you seen, you hear about that and you see studies on that about, you know, white progressives sometimes being just as racist as white conservatives, and but always wanting to black voters or the black electorate to be aligned with their issues. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I believe that white Republicans might be coming from a place of racism. I believe white progressives come from a place of ignorance.
Got it.
And most of them mean well, but if you don't know anybody in the neighborhood, if you don't know anybody in our community, and that's their problem. They tend to go with the things that they know, and it seems to be a little bit easier. Therefore, funding, therefore candidacy, therefore actions and tangible plans tend to go to, all right, I much rather save this street than save the next black body from dying.
Got it.
The progressive side of the house, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from a lack of leadership. I always say this: lack of diversity always negatively affects your bottom line. So, yes, I have seen it. I've seen it up close and personal. I don't want to use the word racism, because these folks will speak to our issues, but maybe the ignorance is the part where they won't put the resources behind it to go forward. It is a systematic problem. It's a very systematic problem where African Americans don't have any safety net to really go to when it comes down to tangibly attacking our issues across the board. If it wasn't for a bunch of Twitter hashtags and a cell phone, we wouldn't have any resources going to our communities right now. And that's a shame, because the original progressive movement in America is the black movement, is the black freedom movement. And everyone learned from our ancestors about how to actively organize, yet and still they don't want to come back to the roots and solve our problems. So, yes, Charles, I do agree with you wholeheartedly that progressives do have the same problems as conservatives when it comes down to black outreach. You should be putting money into black folks' hands. You should be putting money into the consultants. You should be putting money on black television. You should be advertising on TheRoot.com and other black venues. You should be advertising in black papers, the black historical papers. They don't do that because they don't know that that's a part of our universe.
All right. We've been talking with Marcus Farrell. He's a former African-American outreach director for Bernie 2016, also a media consultant with Media Inc., TV senior political partner at ulection.com. You can find him at Marcus for America, the number for America. Is that correct, Marcus? I got it.
You got it.
All right. Catch him on Twitter at Marcus number four America. Hey, Marcus, thanks so much, man. We're going to have you back on.
Thanks, Charles. I appreciate the time, sir.
All right. Take care. After this quick break, we'll be right back here on the Ellison Report with Ken Smaltz, founder of Black Folk Must Vote. He gives us his take on why, well, black folk must vote here at the home of cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. The Ellison Report is made possible by generous support from Oneness Mobility, more at onenessmobility.com, and with support from BE Strategy, more at strategybe.com, and with partners like Zip, the question and answer app, downloadable on your Apple or Android device. Ken Smaltz is the founder and CEO of Black Folk Must Vote. You may have seen the t-shirts around. You can go to blackfolkmustvote.org. for more information, perhaps even buy a t-shirt. That's definitely one t-shirt you got to wear between now and November 8th. Is that correct, Ken? Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I think so. I think, if anything, whenever we go and register to vote, that must be something that we should at least keep in the back of our mind. Not the t-shirt but itself, but the actual message.
Exactly. What inspired you to go with Black Folk Must Vote? Why is that so urgent?
You know, it wasn't, to be honest, it wasn't a slogan that I came up with. It was a button. My aunt was very, very active in voting rights and things of that nature back in the 60s. She actually marched with Martin Luther King. And she collected many buttons in her lifetime. And in her possession, she had a button called Black Folk Must Vote from the 1960s. Hmm. That's where it came from. To make a long story short, she's in the fashion industry. She does backstage for a lot of these different shows. And she, in 2004, during the election, she made up a bunch of buttons, and she wanted to highlight this message. And she produced a bunch of buttons, put it on her people who work backstage. And, Charles, it was amazing how many people who came backstage wanted these buttons. I have pictures on my website of Sean Diddy Combs wearing a Black Folk Must Vote button featured in People magazine. And people actually thought it was a new voting rights initiative that he had.
Right.
So there were so many people who really resonated with this message that soon after that, I said, you know something, this is something that we need to capture, because it is a very, very strong message, especially with what happened in 2000 with African Americans. I think it was around 8,000 African Americans who were not registered to vote. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows what happened with the hanging chads and what have you.
Right.
So I decided to find out who owned this button. I called and spoke to someone. They explained to me that they didn't own it. And so I trademarked.
That was my next question.
So I trademarked it. I trademarked it and then wanted to test it out. And so the first place I tested it out was on the campus of Howard University during their homecoming. And made up a bunch of buttons, and the rest is history.
Now, how's that whole effort been going? I mean, has that been resonating? Because I remember seeing that T-shirt. I bumped into you in Philly during the DNC.
Yes.
Saw that T-shirt. And I remember that T-shirt. I've seen that in a somewhat iconic photo. There's a brother with a baseball cap in his back turned. He's wearing that Black Folk Must Vote
that's
T-shirt. That, is that you? Okay, I didn't realize that. Okay, so now it's all cleared up. Yeah. That's you in that photo. And that photo is circulating. That's why I was like, I got to have that shirt.
Yeah,
I have to get
I
need to get it in black,
Gina.
By the way.
What's that? That was taken in Gina, Louisiana during the, I don't know if you remember, the Gina 6.
Okay, I do remember that. Okay, that is exactly correct.
That's where Flicka took the picture. I saw it maybe soon after that, and then consequently, every year there's a newspaper from a different state that is doing something having to do with voting rights or black votes and things of that, and they use that picture.
They use that pic.
Yeah.
I've used that pic on a Medium blog. I have to admit, yeah. There's something I wanted to write about the black vote, and then you know, I pitched it. And I was trying to get it out. I wanted to get it out like that day. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'll just put it up on Medium. And I used that pick. So just to let you know.
Oh, very
cool. Now, we there's all this conversation about you've got black folk must vote. There's a lot of conversation this election cycle about how black people must register to vote, must right. be active on November 8th, must get to the polls. But black folks have been very active. You know, in 2008, 2012, they were the most active electoral demographic in those presidential elections. But, you know, so why attach this sense of urgency to black voter registration? I mean, black voters, people can make the argument that, well, you know, black voters are voting enough, right?
Well, unfortunately, and you can also add another date, 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why the black vote was so strong during those 3 years is because there was an African-American running for president.
Mm-hmm.
And 84, obviously, was Jesse Jackson.
Right.
So we need to, first of all, not just go out to vote for our own, you know, people, which I'm okay with that, but we also need to concentrate on the midterm elections. We also need to concentrate on the local elections because sometimes those are even more important. I mean, if you look at some of the unarmed African Americans who were killed, and some of the district attorneys that, you know, maybe rushed to judgment and possibly let the police officers go without actually, you know, giving any information as to, you know, what happened and things of that nature. Those district attorneys are put into office during the midterm elections, and that is when we don't go out and vote. It's very important during those elections that we, I mean, granted, during the presidential election, that's when you get the Supreme Courts and things
right.
of that nature. But midterms and local elections are very important, and we as a people don't go out and vote during those times.
And that's when you're very active then all year round. You're not just active every 4 years. You're active during those off cycles as well. Does that message, which you're pushing, I mean, do you feel like it resonates when you try to win? Insert it into those state and local elections, that point you just made?
Well, you know, I'm very small. People used to call me a grassroots organization. I call myself a blade of grass organization. I do what I can. When we first, as I mentioned to you, I first, you know, trademarked the slogan, this was just producing shirts was just something as a mode of, you know, I called it a silent expression of voter responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wear this, and granted, you don't have to say anything. People know exactly what you mean. But I did it in the beginning to find out how people felt about it. And then, consequently, you know, during the 2007-2008 elections, we actually created an initiative. And that initiative, you know, had, you know, certain things that we need to concentrate on. The Supreme Court, at the time, it was stop and frisk, voter suppression, things of that nature. And, you know, I taught in a few schools. I went up to Temple University and I taught some students. I went up to the Art Institute of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke at a school in New York City called Safe Space, which is an organization that deals with, you know, kids at risk. You know, so it wasn't just in the beginning where it was, let me see what the slogan's about. Then it became to creating something that I can get this word out that, you know, African Americans need to vote, not only because of the midterm, because our ancestors died for that right, which is the reason if you look at some of our shirts, it has the number 15 on it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't put the why the number 15 was on it, to create conversation. The number 15 is for the 15th Amendment.
Right.
Is when we got the right to vote in 1870.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a whole learning, you know, curve that I think we need to understand that this is important. This is very important.
What do you say to critics who say that right now you have modern black politics, mm-hmm. You have black millennials, who seem, or a black electorate, which seems very focused on slogans, on hashtags.
Mm.
And there is the sense that there's an inability for that electorate to transition from, you know, the latest kind of social media hype or viral sensation, you know, the latest hashtag or image or video that they saw on social media, mm-hmm. and translate that into something that's actually structural and tangible and operational,
yeah.
in the political sense, that even goes beyond the vote, that gets into creating, you know, not only identifying candidates, but getting them elected, getting political action committees,
yeah.
developed. You know, there is that conversation that's going on that people feel like, you know, nowadays, especially you had mentioned black millennials and young black folks and trying to encourage them to vote. But there is a worry that there's a concern there that they're not transitioning from that protest phase or that slogan yeah. phase to yeah. that active phase.
Yeah. Well, I somehow agree with you. I do agree with the protest, but there needs to be more than just the protest. What we're doing is not a protest.
Mm-hmm.
What my initiative is about showing people the importance of voting and putting people into positions, looking at their records, looking at what's happening in your neighborhoods and going out and making your voice heard. As far as the hashtags, you know, Black Lives Matter and what have you, I do believe they're important. But I have to admit that when they first came out, I said that they should, not giving myself any credit, they should have some kind of a voting arm of that slogan, of that initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And I just recently I heard that they created a slogan called Black Folk, not Black Folk, I apologize. What was it? Black Votes Matter. You know, mm-hmm. I heard about that. Now, I don't know exactly if they're mobilizing, if they're registering people to vote. We are.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that is important. You're absolutely right. And I think our millennials are very apathetic. When I speak to my mm-hmm. nephew
mm-hmm.
and I talk to him about voting and what have you, it's shocking and surprising some of the things that I hear from them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think it's important. And not because of – because I understand when I speak to people when I say inner city, in communities maybe that I'm not familiar with, that I didn't grow up in that manner. I understand maybe when they say, why should I vote? Well, how is that going to change my life? How is that going to change the situation that I'm in? I get that. But the millennials, my nephew, okay, is doing quite well. You know, he grew up in a very, you know, good conditions. He has no right to feel that way, and I don't understand where it comes from, because he didn't grow up in a household like that. But when I speak to a lot of millennials, that's how they feel.
And yeah, how do you
get it?
Yeah, and how do you? There's a lot of conversation about that, and how do you, I guess, bridge that gap? I mean, it's you've been talking about that now for right now during this segment, but I mean, what's the responsibility that us older generations have? Like, you know, we're like around Gen X and older. In terms of helping bridge that perception gap?
Well, I mean, we can only, I guess, show them through our actions. You know, we can show them that we can go out and vote. We can show them how important that is. We can, you know, show them history. I understand how they feel in reference to, you know, that whole marching and all that stuff that, you know, that's not what we do now. Well, if it's not what you do now,
mm-hmm.
don't tell me, because I've heard this before through celebrities out there, that, you know, racism doesn't exist anymore. You know, I that boggles my mind when they look at the last 8 years and the obstruction under the first African-American president, how you can think that it doesn't exist. It exists. It may be different. It may be slightly better, but it's still there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Real quick, I got you for another minute, Ken. So what's sort of the next phase of Black Folk Must Vote? So, like, for example, when you go to the website blackfolkmustvote.org, you know, you have, like, for example, the candidates section, meet the 2016 candidates. You got
yeah.
the two major presidential candidates. But are you focus a lot on state and local elections. Are you looking at, you know, kind of expanding this a bit, you know, after this election cycle, and maybe looking at those, being a little bit more active in a number of ways in those state local elections you talked about?
Well, I've reached out to Congressional Black Caucus in Philly. There's a another organization in I think it's Palm Coast in Florida. That each one of these are battleground states, and they are using our voting rights initiative to knock on doors and to register voters. So I mean that's primarily what I'm doing right now. But once again, you know, just so you know, this is funded by me. I don't have any funding. No one is, you know, come and offered, hey, you know, we like what you're doing. We'd like to spread the word. I'm doing it as a part of, you know, just something that I wanted to do. I just felt very strongly about voting and how important it is. And I just decided to, this is my little, you know, venture into it.
All right. We've been talking with Ken Smaltz. Ken Smaltz is founder and CEO of Black Folk Must Vote. Go to blackfolkmustvote.org for more information and to get active and get one of those T-shirts. I got to get one in black, by the way. So I'll be you'll see that order soon. All right.
You got it.
Hey, Ken, thanks so much, man. We got to have you back on. Keep us posted on how you're making out.
You got it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back with Roddy Lindsay, who is founder and CEO of Hustle, but Hustle.com, not Hustler, Hustle. We'll tell you a little bit more about Hustle when he comes back on the next segment. Here at the home of cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.
When the summer's so forgiving, although we have stolen all of the things that we thought we had on there.
We're back at the Ellison Report, made possible by support from BE Strategy, Strategy Research Communications, more at strategybe.com, and from partners like Oneness Mobility, more at onenessmobility.com. Roddy Lindsay is the CEO and founder of Hustle. It's a text messaging platform for campaigns and also various causes. You can get more information about it at hustle.life. I read with some interest an article that Roddy had written in Campaigns and Election magazine recently. It's called The Rise of Big Organizing. And here Roddy writes, big organizing is so exciting because it uses technology not to automate citizen communication, but to humanize it. And Roddy joins us by phone to talk a little bit more about that. Expound on that, Roddy. How are you doing, by the way?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. So, yeah, what does that mean, technology humanizing rather than automating citizen communication and engagement? Because we seem to have the impression here with all, especially as ubiquitous as technology and platforms have become in campaigns, that there is a lot of automation going on. There's not enough humanizing that's happening, but you argue the opposite.
Yeah, well, I think what we've seen over the past, you know, 20, 25 years, you know, really since email became, you know, such an important tool, is that it's using technology, it's become really easy for campaigns and organizations and really, you know, any type of group that's trying to contact people is to use technology to send lots of communications outwards in a sort of a mass media fashion, right? So everyone's familiar with getting emails in their inbox that kind of maybe it says your name, but you know it's kind of the same email. Everyone's getting the same email. And you know what's really happened is people have kind of tuned out. You know, you think of how many emails you get in your inbox. You know, a lot of them you sort of ignore or you kind of assume, well, it's not a personal email to me, so it's not really that important. And you know, but if you know historically, if you look at what works in campaigns or elections or, you know, any sort of relationship-driven endeavor, is that you have to go one by one and talk to people and not just, you know, have a robot send the messages or send the communications, but really, you know, have a conversation and develop a relationship and try to convince people, you know, of your position and help people with the mechanics of voting, of volunteering, of all these different things. And so what we've done at Hustle over the past year and a half is really try to bake some of these principles, which are really, you know, about organizing, into a platform that organizations and campaigns can use to have these one-on-one conversations at scale.
Mm-hmm.
So really, you know, give these campaigns the power to organize lots of people and have these have these dialogues in a way where they have control.
Mm. And that's through.
And so what,
go ahead.
What we've seen, you know, over the past year and a half is a lot of, you know, very large campaigns and organizations start to use the platform to get their message out. And we've actually sent 20 million messages to and from voters and supporters since we started last year.
20 million?
Yes, 20
wow.
million.
Wow. You know, when I think of your text messaging platform, that paradigm, I kind of go back to what happened several years ago in Ukraine, right? It was like that orange revolution, so to speak, and there was
right.
a lot of talk. And also the Arab Spring. You know, in terms of that all was kind of started, at least reportedly, was all started by, you know, just constant text messaging between organizers and supporters, you know, folks who were out there in those big squares. So, I mean, is that sort of the same sort of fundamentals, is the same principles that you're using with the Hustle platform?
Yeah, I think it's similar, right? I mean, to organize people, you have to. You have a channel, in this case, text messaging, that enables people to have, you know, private one-on-one communications. And I think we've been seeing that, like you said, in Ukraine and the Arab Spring and all these different places. The difference with Hustle is that in a lot of cases, this sort of decentralized, distributed, kind of one-on-one messaging. Is good at doing things very quickly. So, you know, you can fill, you know, Tahrir Square in Egypt, you know, very quickly, which is by getting the word out and having this kind of viral distribution. But when you're talking about sort of, you know, legacy institutions or, you know, campaigns that are, you know, more top down and, you know, have a lot of kind of strategic components and, you know, these you know, leaders at the top that are interested in having control,
mm-hmm.
That a tool like Hustle can help them kind of channel their message and channel their voices and the things that they want people to do through their supporters and their volunteers.
Mm.
So, you know, the channel is the same and the message is the same, but the way that these groups are using it is slightly different.
And Roddy, and I got you for about a couple more minutes. How does the use of tools like that, you know, there's sort of like a bit of a crowdsourcing effect to those tools, but how does that evolve with, or how does it, you know, sort of contrast with, you know, those traditional methods, you know, that are popularly used, that are still heavily relied on, whether it's like, you know, big ads on TV or, you know, even to a certain extent, social media, like stuff like Twitter and Facebook are becoming like traditional or conventional. Who would have thunk that happening? And so how does that all kind of evolve with it or contrast with it? I mean, or is there a lot of friction and tension there?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a lot of campaigns and groups kind of separate how they think about things in terms of kind of digital communications, which would be your email and your social media, and then your field, which is your you know, door knocking and phone calling and all that kind of traditional voter and supporter outreach. And I think more and more the lines are being blurred. And a tool like Hustle is sort of both, right? It's a digital platform, so it's used by people on their phone. You know, they use our app on their phones. They use our administration tool on their browser. So it's a digital tool, but fundamentally, it's about field. It's about having one-on-one voter contact.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think how this evolves is there's going to be more and more we're going to see the lines blur, where these sort of social channels and traditional kind of mass outreach tools are going to be used as ways to spark conversations with voters and supporters. And field efforts, this one-on-one voter contact, are going to be augmented by these digital tools. So I see this, so that's how I see it playing out, is that, you know, there's no longer, you know, going to be a clear role for digital and a clear role for field, but
right.
both are going to work together in concert
right.
To build these relationships and get the word out.
Got it. We've been talking with Roddy Lindsay. He is founder and CEO of Hustle. It is a text messaging campaign platform. You can get more information at hustle.life, and you can also download the app. Is that correct? The Hustle app.
The app is available for our users. Yes, go to hustle.life to
get more information.
Talk to the sales platform. Yeah.
Excellent. Hey, Roddy, thanks so much, man. And definitely check out his piece in Campaigns and Elections magazine, The Rise of Big Organizing. So we'll talk to you again, man.
I appreciate it. Thank
All
you
right.
so much.
Take care. All right, and that wraps this week's edition of the Ellison Report. I'm your host, Charles Ellison. Go to ellisonreport.com for more information. This was made possible by generous support from Oneness Mobility. More at onenessmobility.com. Touch base with us at Ellison Report on Twitter. Continue to listen in at the home of cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.